Hi, everybody. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. I'm Rick Polson. I'm your host. I'm also the executive director of LRIS, and this is a special part two of our January episode, where in part one, we looked back to what we thought were the kind of most interesting trends and cases of 2025. And that was according to our crack panel consisting of me. And in 2026, we're going to have predictions. We reached out, we polled me, and we asked me what I thought the most important trends would be for 2026 looking ahead. And so that's what we're going to talk about this week, or on this kind of half episode of the First Thursday podcast. So stick around, and I'll tell you what I think are going to be the important issues in 2026. Before we get into the 2026 predictions, just want to remind you what's happening at LRIS. If you want any information about our seminars, check us out at lris.com/seminars. We've got three coming up in the first part of 2026, our Union Leadership Seminar in Nashville from January 28 to 30. And then we have our Collective Bargaining Seminar again at the end of March. Again, going to focus or be back in Nashville, Tennessee. Those dates are going to be March 26th through 28th. Both are going to be at the Sonesta Hotel in Nashville. And then we'll be back in Las Vegas at the Horseshoe in the Paris from June 18th to 20th for our Rights of Police Officers seminar. That's usually a lot of fun. And so hopefully, if you've never been to an LRIS seminar, come on out and see us. Those are three pretty good opportunities, two on the East Coast, one on the West Coast. So something that we talk about at pretty much every LRIS seminar is the economy, right? What's been happening with the economy? What do we think is going to happen with the economy? And we do that because it's really important, you know, for our folks at the bargaining table. And that's on the union side and on the management side, right? We all want to get the best contract we can get. And we know that, you know, for the most part, you know, that's going to be limited by the employer's finances. And if we're talking about, you know, contract terms that are generally going to be 3 years, sometimes they're longer, sometimes they're shorter, depending on what part of the country you're in. Shout out to Oklahoma with your 1 year contracts. You know, we have to do a little bit of predicting, you know, when we're agreeing to a 3 year contract. We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with the economy. And so we have to think about what's ahead. And sometimes I'll review that information, and sometimes we'll have a labor economist come in and talk about those things. If you're interested in a deep dive in that, come out to our bargaining seminar in Nashville in March. Jeremy Krimmel, a labor economist, is going to be talking about how to look at the economy and how to assess an employer's ability to pay. That's always a really interesting presentation. And so, you know, you get to know, you know, what the things are that are important in making those presentations. And there's always a bit of prediction. So I thought that might be a good place for us to start out, but there is going to be some real predicting. So not, you know, I'm going to go out a little bit of a further limb than I would at a conference where I'm just kind of showing here's what we're seeing in the economy, right? And here's what economists, here's what most economists are suggesting is going to happen, you know, in the next quarter or two, or in the next year or two, because that's what they do. I want to give you my own, you know, personal predictions on that. So, you know, what have we seen with respect to the economy? The economy has actually been really, we've done this for the last 5 years. The U.S. economy is really resilient, right? The U.S. economy, we came out of COVID better than any other country, you know, in the world. And we try to keep the politics out of this stuff because, you know, each party likes to blame the other party for things. But the fact is, regardless of who was in charge and when they were in charge, the U.S. economy has proven to be really resilient. It was in really good shape in 2024, and it's continued to actually to grow fairly significantly in 2025. And that's throughout, you know, all of the uncertainty and trauma associated with the Trump administration, mostly as it relates to the economy. It's going to be because of tariffs and uncertainty, right? That's been the watchword, uncertainty over tariffs and trade and things like that. And we get through the end of that first year of the Trump administration, and it's like, hey, you know, the economy is actually still doing pretty well, right? And most economists, as we hit, like, you know, right when the government shut down, most economists, you know, were saying, well, our outlook for 26 was, you know, we're going to have kind of modestly rising inflation. You know, job growth is not super great, right? You know, maybe pretty lackluster. You know, we're going to deal with the impact of the shutdown. So we have uncertainty, but the economy is doing okay. And, you know, a lot of that, of those reports that we got, you know, in the October, November timeframe were to a certain extent, economists were flying blind because they didn't have access to information that the federal government, if it was operational, would be generating and reporting. And so December, we got a lot of kind of catch-up information with respect to how the economy reported. And, you know, it was actually really strong. So if we look at a couple of things, you know, inflation is down, right? You know, inflation has come down from the big highs, you know, in 22 and in 2023. And it had been, you know, we thought that it was down around 3%, it was going to go below 3%, you know, as we ended 2024. But inflation has proven pretty stubborn. It is, you know, it came down a little bit at the end of the year, you know, 2.7% inflation, but a lot closer to 3% than the 2%, which is what we would want to see. And it had been higher at earlier points of the year. I think that a lot of folks were concerned, and some folks are still concerned about the impact of tariffs, you know, on inflation. I think, you know, again, if you try to take the politics out of it, and, you know, I'm not a fan of the tariffs. No one yet has been able to explain to me a good reason, honestly, a good reason for the administration's tariff strategy other than the president wants to do it. But that said, you know, I think a lot of folks have been surprised at the limited impact that tariffs have had so far on the economy. And there's still, you know, a lot of unwinding to do. There's a lot of threatening, right, of inflated tariff rates that weren't imposed. But, you know, tariffs, you know, the collective tariff rate in this country is higher than it's been in several decades. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, I don't know. The consensus seems to be that consumers are pretty much paying the costs of that, but we haven't seen it have as much of a drag on CPI or an inflative effect on CPI as we would have expected. So inflation is still higher than we'd like to see, but, you know, not as bad as a lot of folks had thought. You know, the labor market's problematic, right? The economy is just not adding jobs at the rate that it was in 2025. Unemployment is up. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, significant cooling. We've seen throughout 2025 significant cooling in the labor market. We shall see, you know, where that goes. And, you know, the combined effect of inflation, you know, not being where economists would like to see it, on the labor market cooling, you know, it's been that consumer spending has also cooled. You know, consumer spending is down. It has been down throughout 25. We'll talk a little bit about consumer confidence. And so that's not great, but, you know, I think a lot of folks expected consumer spending to tank, and it hasn't. Again, this is a really resilient economy. And there are a lot of positives, you know. So what are we seeing? We're seeing borrowing costs continue to fall. We saw the Fed reduce rates on several occasions in 2025. Whether you agree or disagree with the Trump administration's approach toward the Fed, a heavy-handed approach toward the Fed, and maybe specifically Jerome Powell, you know, reasonable minds can agree to disagree on. Well, actually, I think every reasonable mind agrees that the administration's approach to the Fed is not great. That said, we've seen a gradual decreasing of rates. And my expectation is we're going to continue to see that in 2026, especially as we have changeover, you know, at the top of the Fed. So that's good. The borrowing costs are falling. The stock market had a fantastic year. I think it was up 16-17% for the year in 2025. So clearly, notwithstanding all of that uncertainty, right, about you know, inflation, uncertainty about trade policy, tariffs, you know, the market generally has liked what it has been seeing with respect to the economy, and certainly the market liked the big tax cut bill that passed in the summer. And then finally, you know, this is probably the most important and surprising economic news that we got in December was the rate of growth in the economy in the third quarter of the most recent fiscal year. And so the economy grew at the rate of 4.3% in the third quarter. Now, this was after shrinking in the first quarter of 2025. And that was the general consensus seems to be that that was because employers were importing more to get out ahead of tariffs, right? And so the economy contracted a little bit, but then it rebounded. It grew by 3.8% in the second quarter. Economists were predicting maybe growth around that range again, but it came in at 4.3% in the third quarter, which was really, really strong. And so I think we ended the year in a much better place, I would say, than you know, where most folks expected that we would be. This is my prediction, you know, not the economist's prediction. Economists, by the way, are continuing to predict, you know, steady growth in the economy. You know, there's going to be probably a little more turbulence, a little more uncertainty still around tariffs and tariff policy. You know, what's happening in Venezuela probably isn't helping, you know, with respect to economic outlooks. But I still think there's general sense the economy is stable and economists are relatively positive about the state of the economy right now, notwithstanding some of those things. I'm actually a little rosier about the economy. I think that, you know, the GDP growth in the third quarter, I don't think you can chalk that up to the federal government was shut down and the math was bad. You know, I think that that was really encouraging to see. You know, interest rates are going to, they're going to go down. You know, whether you think the Trump administration's handling of the Fed and efforts to exert control over what historically has been and probably should be a non-political entity. So whether you think the administration's approach is the correct one or not, you know, it's effective. And there has been downward pressure. So I would expect that you're going to see rates reduce, you know, faster than most economists would predict. And I think that's just reflecting the politics and the reality of it. Whether it's good policy, whether it's good economic policy, I don't think matters, you know, at least in 2026. I think we're just going to see it. You're going to see the stock market respond. The key for me is going to be consumer confidence. You know, we're in a really weird, you know, period of consumer confidence. Consumers, you know, really haven't recovered from COVID. You know, and then that was, you know, throughout the end of the first Trump administration and throughout the Biden administration, now the Trump administration. Again, I will say that, you know, consumer confidence was on the rebound in 2024. And with the transition to the Trump administration in 2025, it really took a nosedive. And so it's pretty low. We see the impact of tariff policy, of trade policy, make its way through to a greater extent on the price of goods and services, and we see inflation tick back up, is that going to, and we see consumer confidence levels decrease, I think that's that would be a big problem. We haven't seen it yet, and I have a feeling, you know, and this is just one person's prediction, I have a feeling that 2026 may be the year in which consumer confidence kind of catches up with some of these other things that we've been seeing in the economy. We shall see, but my prediction for 2026 as it relates to the state of the economy is the economy is going to be pretty strong in 26. And I'm not saying that because I want my clients to get good contracts. I do want my clients to get good contracts, but I also just happen to think we're looking at a good year in the economy. I hope I'm right. And you probably hope I'm right too. We shall see. Prediction number two for 2026 as it relates to public safety, labor relations, is that the poaching will continue. Last episode, we talked about the downside of recruiting and retention crisis. The good side being it's pretty easy to get a good contract these days because you know, the market is speaking and it's harder to find and keep police officers and firefighters and correction officers. And contracts reflect that. So we've seen bigger raises, fewer concessions, you know, all that kind of stuff at the bargaining table. Now, There are some downsides to that. You know, we've lowered standards. There could be and probably will be negative consequences related to that that we may see in coming years. We've seen erosion in bargaining rights, maybe in ways that we haven't expected, as employers have taken steps to address unprecedented staffing and safety issues in ways that they probably would have had to bargain before. And we talked about that last week. But, you know, I don't think anything's changing. In fact, I think the recruiting and retention situation is going to get worse for law enforcement, for sure, and corrections. Maybe not so much for fire, but I think it's going to get worse in 2026. And the reason why I think it's going to get worse is because of the federal government. You know, and the poaching that I'm talking about isn't just the good old-fashioned poaching that we used to get, which used to consist of Florida department stealing police officers from the rest of the country, right? Which is kind of what used to happen and what still happens. No, I'm talking about the federal government stealing candidates or stealing police officers, and not stealing them, right? But incentivizing them to come over and work for the federal government. If you watch a football game, pro or college football game, you know, at any time over this last season, you saw, or if you're like me, you saw plenty of ICE recruiting videos, right? That big, beautiful Bill Act had $100 million in spending for federal law enforcement officers in it. And a lot of that money is earmarked at recruiting and retention efforts in order to convince people to come and work for the federal government. And so, you know, pretty much everywhere you see on social media and on TV, there are commercials talking about Uncle Sam, you know, needing you, right, to come and work for the federal government, you know, using some pretty aggressive, you know, recruiting campaigns. My favorite, you know, meme that I've seen is, you know, the Uncle Sam pointing the finger and, you know, saying America's been invaded by criminals and predators and we need you to get them out, right? $50,000 signing bonus with an asterisk, $60,000 in student loan repayments with an asterisk, 25% premium pay asterisk. You always got to check the fine print, you know, with these guys, but there's lots of money out there. That is for sure. And a big effort to recruit people to come and not just work for ICE, but work, you know, in lots of areas of federal law enforcement. That's a big deal. Yeah, at least with respect to coverage that we've seen out there of recruiting efforts, and then just anecdotal stuff that we hear here at LRS, it has been effective. You know, lots of people are looking, you know, for work with respect to the federal government, in law enforcement. And so, you know, when you advertise, people advertise for a reason, right? It tends to work. And so we are seeing an uptick. It'll be interesting to see, you know, once we get documentation on the numbers of new folks coming into federal law enforcement and where they are coming from, to gauge the impact at the local level. But I've heard a lot of anecdotal concern at the local level about the federal government, you know, basically looking to steal municipal police officers, you know, or sheriffs, deputy sheriffs at a time when those departments need everybody they can get. Great example of that is the president's DC task force, right? The recruiting for DC task force that started, you know, to get really loud, you know, around November, October, November, you know, with the president getting on Truth Social and, you know, recruiting all great law enforcement patriots, you know, come join us in the federal government, and basically saying you could do whatever the hell you want. you know, it's a good financial package, but you're going to be able to police like you used to, like that kind of stuff. And, you know, that could be red meat and that could be pretty effective. And with respect to the park police, you know, in DC, there are, I think they offered a $70,000 hiring bonus. And they basically hold out that, you know, we don't really have a pursuit policy. You know, they're marketing, you know, and recruiting, you know, police officers who may feel like they're limited in the way that they can enforce the law. The federal government is essentially saying, come work for us. You know, the gloves are off. You can do what you want. That's a pretty effective message. Now, I also think it's an overly simplistic, and I would suggest pretty insulting message to law enforcement officers, given the degree of complexity involved in that profession. And it might reflect the view of the administration of law enforcement officers, and that's not a flattering view necessarily. But that said, there's a lot of effort and action and money behind this. And so, you know, I'm not sure how the Park Police has been doing with respect to that effort, but there's a ton of money there. The Secret Service is the most recent agency to highly publicize its outreach. They're looking to expand by 20%, you know, over the next 3 years. And they know that's a, you know, that's going to be a real tough thing to do. That's a unique, you know, agency to recruit for, given the travel requirements. They are in the midst of their own very real staffing crisis. And they're saying, not only are we going to, you know, maintain, we're going to grow by 20%. Well, where are these folks coming from? Right. You know, if they're not coming from outside of law enforcement, they're coming from municipal police departments. And that's going to be a problem. We already know about ICE, tons of money with respect to ICE's recruiting. And, you know, there has been some pushback, you know, from the sheriffs and from other groups, you know, kind of basically along the lines of the federal government is coming and poaching from our agencies. There's a great quote from a story. It was like earlier in the year where you had a sheriff saying, you know, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, you know, and you're robbing the poorest Peter to pay the richest of Paul. The federal government has all the money and all the resources they need. It's not fair. We can't compete with the feds when it comes to this. And it's a really different approach than what we saw back in the 90s with the COPS program, right? You know, you could make a lot of comparisons to what we're seeing in the country today as it relates to what we saw with respect to crime, you know, in the 90s, and an increased attention and demand by the public for safer communities, you know, and more police officers. And, you know, Clinton ran on that, right? You know, he's a new kind of Democrat. He's a law and order Democrat. Aside from the politics of that, the reality was that the federal government spent its money to provide more local police officers, right? So it was federal money funding local municipal police officers. And of course, they did the same thing with safer money for firefighters. This is essentially the same thing. And, you know, a similar investment in law enforcement. What is the federal government doing? They're saying, no. We're not going to let you city police departments, you know, spend money the way that you want to spend it. We're going to have people come to us, work for us, build a big federal law enforcement agency. And then maybe we'll go to your city and we'll supplement, you know, maybe whether you like it or not. Yeah, we might do that. And so it's a real, it's not just money, it's control. That's a very different approach than we've seen prior administrations take. And, you know, it's certainly not going to make recruiting efforts and retention efforts at the local level, you know, more successful. Now, the good news, I guess, for local unions at bargaining tables is it probably is going to make the recruiting and retention issue in law enforcement, you know, worse. And that's going to give you a stronger hand at the bargaining table. So sometimes bad news is good news. That's my prediction anyway. It's going to get worse before it gets better, if it gets better. And we're just going to have to see what happens with the feds in 2026. Okay, prediction number three has to do with what we're going to see in the courts, and specifically what we should expect to see with respect to equal employment litigation, you know, mostly in federal courts in 2026. I think we're going to see a real change. We've already seen a change start, and I think the rubber is going to meet the road in 2026. You know, by way of background, if we're going to talk about legal standards, we can talk about the biggest court in the land, the highest court in the land. Anyway, the Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice John Roberts. The Roberts Court, you know, during the Chief Justice's tenure, has really changed the direction of the Supreme Court as it relates to general employment and other equality issues. And the one quote from Justice Roberts from a case decided in 2007, you know, is what just comes up again and again and again. And the quote is, "The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race," right? That's your Chief Justice, in a case involving what sometimes are called as reverse discrimination claims. And so what are the rights of the majority group as applied to equal opportunity laws, right, that were intended of course, to treat everybody equally, but with an intent, you know, to help generally minority groups, right, who were being unfairly treated in a number of ways. What if you're a member of the majority group? Well, for 50 years, you were kind of out of luck, right? But we've seen the court, and this is before Trump, right? You know, this is a gradual shift to the right in the court of hostility towards Title VII and other kind of race-based protections. You can expand that to other types of protections too, but we've certainly seen that. And so the Roberts Court, you know, really seems to focus on, you know, formal equality over like group-based justice, right? So the focus is on the individual. Is that individual being treated fairly? I don't care what, you know, whether they're in the majority or the minority group, how are they being treated as opposed to any kind of group goals? The Roberts Court definitely is focusing on kind of the text, right? A textualist approach to civil rights. So we're going to focus on what does the statute say? What do the statutes say? Not the goals necessarily that the statutes were intended to achieve. And, you know, the court has really been, you know, skeptical of any, I guess you'd call it DEI-driven, you know, decision-making. And we've seen that in case after case that's come down from the Supreme Court. So this court is really critical of policies that explicitly consider race, sex, you know, things like that, you know, in any part of decision-making, you know, even when done for, you know, really good reasons, for progressive reasons or, you know, remedial reasons. You know, a couple of years ago, probably the highest profile version of that was when the court issued its decision in the Harvard case over college admissions, and the court overturned prior precedent and held that the goal of achieving a diverse student body, right, which is a you know, a good goal, right, a laudable goal, that goal can't justify using race as a plus factor in college admissions. And if when colleges do that, you know, and Harvard College in particular did that, it violated the Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and also the Civil Rights Act. You know, the court gave caveats and said you can still, you know, in an essay consider an applicant's explanation of how race influenced them in relation to, you know, their leadership abilities and their character, but like you can't just check a box and say you get 10 more points because you're a member of this particular group. That was a big deal when the court decided that. Last year, they decided a case, less significant case, but just a more recent indicator of how the court sees these issues in Ames versus Ohio Department of Youth Services. There was a what you would call kind of a reverse discrimination claim raised by a heterosexual woman who alleged she was denied promotion, and she was in fact later demoted in favor of gay colleagues, essentially was the allegation there. And the court was asked to ring in on the legitimacy of a test used under Title VII that was applied for majority group plaintiffs as applied to minority group plaintiffs, a little extra hurdle that majority group plaintiffs would have to satisfy in order to make a case that minority group plaintiffs would not have to satisfy. And the court said, nope, that's not how we do it here. Right, it's going to be the same test for everybody. Pretty indicative of how the court, you know, looks at these things. Okay, that sets the stage. Why am I predicting, you know, big changes or high profile changes in 2026? Well, let me read something for you. Right, you may have seen this on X, you know, or on Facebook or on someone else. And, you know, imagine I'm an ambulance. I should have been an ambulance chaser. Probably would have been great fun. I'd probably make a ton of money and not have to do any squat. But this is like the ultimate ambulance chaser, you know, commercial or billboard. And let me read it to you. Are you a white male who has experienced discrimination at work based on your race or sex? If so, contact the EEOC as soon as possible. You may have a claim to recover money under the federal civil rights laws. Right? That's like ambulance chaser, you know, language. You know who that came from? The chair of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, the chair of the EEOC, Andrea Lucas, right, on social media is basically looking for plaintiffs. Are you a white male? Have you been discriminated against? Call us. You may have money. That's extraordinary. That's an extraordinary step for the EEOC, the head of the EEOC, to take, basically inviting charges, right, from what I would call majority plaintiffs, looking for cases to bring. Now, the EEOC rarely will bring a case. You know, if you file a discrimination charge, most likely what's going to happen is the commission is not going to take your case. They're going to ultimately say, we don't know what to tell you. They're going to issue you what we call a right to sue letter, and then maybe you bring a suit, maybe you don't. But they will take cases occasionally, and usually they'll take a few hundred cases a year. In 2025, they took very few cases, and partly that could be because of big reductions, right, at the EEOC as part of federal downsizing. But the EEOC was much less active in 2025. Even among the few cases that they brought individually, it was the lowest number of race and national origin cases that they filed, you know, in a decade. And a lot of those cases, you know, or a greater percentage of those cases than we had seen before, were these so-called kind of reverse discrimination cases. I think, you know, 2025 was a year for the commission to kind of rearrange and get its new priorities in place. And what we started to see and what we're starting to see on social media from the EEOC, and this started in December, is going to continue through to 2026. They're going to be very active. They're going to be looking for excuses to sue employers, you know, to challenge what they would call DEI policies. And I'll note that in April of 2024, the administration issued an executive order specifically, you know, I would say outlawing is probably not the correct word for it, but seeking the elimination of any and all DEI programs in law enforcement agencies, right? And so, if you're working in a law enforcement agency and you believe that you know, you're concerned about promotional policies or the way that assignments are made or things along those lines, and you go to the EEOC, you're going to have a much friendlier organization there waiting for your complaint than we've ever seen. And so that's a real sea change. And another change that we saw the administration issue was a decision that the EEOC was no longer going to pursue what we call disparate impact claims. And disparate impact claims, a disparate impact discrimination claim, is a type of claim where you have a policy that is facially neutral, right? You have a test, right? Everyone takes the same test. Or you have a physical agility or ability test, right? It's the same test that everybody takes. But, you know, when you apply a neutral policy and you look at the outcomes, it can have a discriminatory outcome. You can have a test that's drafted in a way that certain people are more likely to fail than others. That's the gist of it, right? I don't need to get into the science behind that. And, you know, the existence of disparate impact discrimination claims, you know, can be traced back to a Supreme Court case from 1971, Griggs versus Duke Power. So this is a pretty big deal, a longstanding a policy that the EEOC would pursue disparate impact. And the federal government said, nope, doesn't exist anymore. It never happened. There is no such thing as disparate impact. And if you give a test and white candidates do worse than black candidates, or black candidates do worse than white candidates, we don't care, right? As long as the test is on its face neutral, we don't have a problem with it. What does that mean if you have physical ability tests, right, that might be might have a disparate impact on female candidates as opposed to male candidates? We don't care, right? The EEOC doesn't have a problem with that stuff anymore. That's a big deal. That's a sea change. And so I think what we're going to see in 2026, and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I have no idea, but it's a change. And it's something to keep an eye on. And it's something to be aware of, especially for unions and management where you have provisions in your collective bargaining agreements. If you're involved in the promotional process, or if you have physical agility tests that are tied to any type of benefit, maybe a bonus if you pass a test, or you don't pay a healthcare premium if you pass a test, or something like that, you might be on the hook if somebody goes to the EEOC and sues, files a charge against their city because they don't like the way that these physical ability tests are applied. The the union might be brought in as a defendant in that suit. So it's something that we need to keep an eye on. It's certainly a pretty big change. And so my prediction for 2026 is that the EEOC will be very aggressive with respect to reverse discrimination charges. And we're going to see that hit public safety agencies in a meaningful way in 26. Okay, that's it. That's three predictions for 2026. The economy is going to boom. The federal government is going to steal law enforcement officers from local agencies. And there are going to be big changes with respect to any equal employment opportunity things, at least as far as the federal government is concerned. Talk to me next January and let me know if I was right or wrong. If you agree, disagree with any of this kind of stuff, just shoot us an email. Give us your comments at info@lrs.com. If you like what you hear, or if you don't like what you hear and you want to listen to it again, just like or follow, share the podcast. The more the merrier as far as we're concerned. That's it for January. I'm Rick Polson signing off. I hope everybody has a safe month, and we'll talk to you again in February. Thanks a lot.